Welcome, listeners, to this episode on the peoples of the Anglo-Saxon period. I'm Ash, your host, and I'm joined here today with three experts of the groups that lived or arrived in England during this time. We will examine how Anglo-Saxon arrival changed and shaped the culture and language of England, and we'll go over the Vikings and the lasting material and geographical legacy they left behind. The Celts have been the native people of Britain since the Iron Age, with many tribes living in England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. So after the Celts, everything changes around the 5th century. I'm joined here with expert Will. So who's arriving on British shores?
Well, this is when the Anglo-Saxons show up, mostly consisting of Angles, Saxons, and Jutes, coming from northern Germany and Denmark. And they're not arriving peacefully. They're fighting the remaining Britons, and also fighting each other as their new kingdoms form.
So it's not one unified Anglo-Saxon invasion, but multiple groups fighting for territory.
Exactly. Places like Wessex, Kent, and Northumbria emerge from this competitive landscape.
And geographically, where do they actually settle?
Mainly in the south and east. This is even more evident in the place names they left behind. Anything ending in Tun, Ham, Bury, Lee, and Ford, that's Anglo-Saxon.
Oxford literally meaning the ford for oxen has always been one of my favourites.
It's a perfect example. They named places for what they did there. Farming, fortifying, crossing rivers. Bur or borough refers to fortress and marks the defensive networks the Anglo-Saxons established to defend against Viking invasions. Places like Middlesbrough and Peterborough still bear this history.
Now, their language is where things get really interesting, because Old English isn't just a language, but gives an insight into how they thought.
Absolutely. Old English words are incredibly descriptive. Place names, personal names, even landscape terms show how people interact with land, with family, and with their gods.
So their language, culture, and religion are all tied together?
Completely. Take their pagan beliefs. They worshipped Woden, Tunor, and Tyr, and their names are survived in Wednesday, Thursday, and Tuesday, in addition to places like Wansdyke and Thundersley. That's religion shaping everyday speech for centuries, also seen in material objects they used.
So how did that impact the pre-existing Celtic languages?
The Anglo-Saxons hybridised their Old English language with existing Celt and Roman place names too. They kept the names for major rivers that originated with the Celts, which shows the importance as geographical markers. Carisbrook, for example, combines the Celtic name for stream, Carry, with the Old English brook. Major cities like Exeter, Gloucester, Leicester, and Manchester followed a similar pattern, using the Roman word Chester, meaning fort.
Speaking of hybrid culture, you've mentioned that the Anglo-Saxons also used the landscape to remember battles.
They did. A dramatic example is Sitchelm's Barrow, named after an early West Saxon leader. Later traditions claim he killed 2,065 Britons on Bees Hill, showing how the memory of the warrior mattered.
So the places became monuments, not just locations.
Exactly. The barrow itself is prehistoric, older than Sitchelm by thousands of years, but naming it after him allowed the West Saxon rulers to tie themselves to a heroic past. They turned geography into propaganda.
Right, so let's talk objects. What did the Anglo-Saxons leave behind that show us who they were?
If we start with more grandiose material artifacts, from them we learn about how the Anglo-Saxons' religious and cultural identity was very diverse. For example, within the famous Sutton Hoo burial, where it's supposed a king called Raedwald was buried between 590 and 640 AD, ornate shoulder clasps were found with what could be seen as a very multi-faith design.
How so?
Historians have suggested that although the designs on the shoulder clasps seem at first to contain animalistic iconography, usually associated with Germanic paganism, such as the intertwined images of boars and snakes, the whole image, especially the pine cone at the centre of the design, closely resembles Christian iconographic depictions of the Garden of Eden. This suggests the Anglo-Saxons, at least during their first centuries in Britain, showed signs of strong intermixing and cultural exchange, mixing their old ways with the new.
Right, so did we know much about Anglo-Saxon material culture before their arrival in Britain?
Well, traditionally it was believed the Anglo-Saxons belonged to a wide Pan-Germanic culture, meaning they shared cultural aesthetics with the peoples of Germania and Scandinavia. However, more recently historians have suggested artistic styles found in Anglo-Saxon grave goods may actually have Roman influence, especially as their zoomorphic artistic style has many links with late Roman hunting imagery.
So what we can take from this is that the Anglo-Saxons, who are already a diverse group, also express themselves using styles from a variety of places and peoples. Of course, as with any society, their faith would have been important to them. Can you tell us about what the Anglo-Saxons believed in?
Although the Anglo-Saxon religion before they converted to Christianity is obscure, we know that there was a slow process over the first couple of centuries of their settlement in Britain where they moved away from their pagan beliefs towards Christianity. As we saw when we're looking at the mix of pagan and religious symbolism in the Sutton Hoo grave, Anglo-Saxon elite's conversion to Christianity was gradual.
And what about everyday life? Is there something we can learn from the smaller discoveries?
Well, food tells us a lot. Early Anglo-Saxon bread was rough and made from home ground flour. Roman favourites like olive oil also disappeared from Anglo-Saxon diets. We don't find kitchens until the 9th century, and when they do appear, they're a sign of elite households. Upper classes kept certain foods themselves, like turbot, sturgeon, and even dolphins. But everyone, both rich and poor, ate freshwater fish, such as eels.
And after the Anglo-Saxons, the Vikings arrived, bringing their own naming traditions, their own lives, which had their own impacts on English life. I'm now joined by Viking expert Tilly. So, when did the Vikings arrive, and where from, Tilly?
It was late 800s, so the 9th century, and it was the Danish Vikings who captured Northumbria and its capital in 1867, which they soon renamed Jorvik.
Where else did they then recapture?
Quite a large chunk of England, spanning from modern-day Lancashire and Yorkshire, all the way down to East Anglia. This area then began being ruled under Danish law.
And what signs of their settlement can be found?
Scandinavian language had quite a large impact on English, and is especially present in place names. Across the land they occupied, loads of settlements still bear distinctly Scandinavian names.
Can you give us some examples?
Dale comes from their word for valley, and so there are dozens of valleys and villages in Yorkshire, all with that suffix. Two of the most common in settlements are Bee and Thorpe, which indicate primary and then secondary settlements, meaning most Bees today are towns or villages, whilst Thorpes are often small villages or hamlets. Other examples include Thwaite, which means a clearing or meadow, Garth, an enclosure, Gill, a ravine, Keld, a well or spring, Ness, a headland or coast settlement, Stee, a pathway, and Scar, an outcrop of bare rock.
Right, so would Scarborough be an example of that?
Actually, no, although it's not completely known. It is a Danish settlement, but Borough, as discussed earlier, is typically an Anglo-Saxon name. They established many boroughs across Danish-occupied lands in attempts to fight back against the occupation, so it could have something to do with that. The original name, though, ends with Borg, which is the Old Norse word for a fortified place, so Borough could have developed later at the similarity of the two languages. It's then been suggested that Skarbit was named after a Viking raider called Thorgils Skarthi, although there isn't any actual archaeological evidence to support that. It's based only upon inferences from old stories.
Are there lots of hybrid names?
Yeah, a lot combine English names with Scandinavian words, which therefore signal that they took over old English settlements, as opposed to creating their own from scratch. Lots of Bees, though, get their first part from names of Danish settlers or rulers, the whole name therefore being created by Viking settlers.
Did they name them upon occupation?
No, actually. Nearly all places that include Viking personal names developed after the Danes lost a lot of their land in the early 900s. They were clearly therefore named in an attempt to stake their ownership amid fears that they would lose it.
What are some examples of this?
Well, there are 210 Bees and 155 Thorpes in Yorkshire alone, but with the major example would be Grimsby in Lincolnshire, with Grim having been a Danish fisherman. Prefixes also could come from other Old Norse words. Any place including Kirby comes from Kirk, being their word for church, meaning those places will have been, of course, church villages.
Were these all named by Viking settlers then?
Not necessarily. The languages melding with English meant that some places could have been named by non-Vikings at later dates, at that point using words that serve only as Viking legacy.
So Scandinavian-style place names don't necessarily mean a place has Viking history.
Precisely. It's also important to note that due to some similarities between Old Norse and other languages present in England at the time, some suffixes that seem Scandinavian might not actually be. The Viking word for creek or bay, for example, was vik, which occurs in many place names today as wick. Wick could also, however, be based on the Anglo-Saxon word for port.
I guess all places need to be studied quite carefully then.
Absolutely. It's tempting, of course, to draw overarching conclusions, but there's still contestation about the origins of many place names and what they can tell us about Viking life. Archaeology often presents more certain claims.
So we are now joined by another one of our Viking specialists, Magda. What material evidence can be used to help support these claims and also establish a large picture of Viking settlements?
We are extremely lucky to have such well-preserved artefacts from archaeological digs, specifically ones which took place here in Yorkshire and Lincolnshire in the late 20th and 21st centuries.
And what have these digs uncovered about the settlements of Vikings in Britain?
Well, prior to these digs, historians believed that Viking settlements in Britain from the 9th century were small and temporary as a result of strained relations from neighbouring Anglo-Saxon settlements. However, recent discoveries from metal detectorists and archaeological digs have somewhat disproved this hypothesis. Focusing on the archaeological digs in Torksey, Lincolnshire, material evidence discovered was largely to do with metalwork processing.
Does the significance of the evidence being metalwork highlight any key details about Viking life at this point?
Absolutely. It tells us that the settlement which landed in Torksey was short-term, as was initially theorised, centred on the first stage of land occupation, looting. The metalwork consisted primarily of fragments of silver, Scandinavian jewellery, and artefacts which point towards the establishment of the metalworks industry.
So what historical theories changed as a result of the findings in Torksey?
The main change was Viking settlements were found to be much larger than initially thought.
These metalwork pieces which were found, did they serve a trade purpose?
They did indeed serve a purpose within the realm of trade. While some of the goods may have been melted down in order to create military materials, others may have been traded as part of the bullion economy which operated amongst Viking settlers during the century. The obtained assemblage may have been traded for less tangible goods such as slaves, who formed an intrinsic aspect of labour and construction in Viking settlements.
Was any evidence found which would point towards a later stage of more long-term settlements?
The findings in Stamford Bridge and Coppergate both point towards much longer-term settlements and offer a more in-depth insight into the daily domestic sphere of Viking settlers in England. As we mentioned before, early stages of settlement consisted of looting and resource gathering, and the later phase consisted of the settling up of an Anglo-Scandinavian farmstead.
What did these digs uncover which differentiates them from the evidence of early-stage Viking settling and looting?
Starting with Coppergate, digs uncovered metal brooches, immediately pointing towards a more domestic settlement based on long-term living.
Do these brooches offer any insight into the more personal aspects of Viking settlement in Yorkshire?
Absolutely. In fact, it opens the door on gender roles in Viking settlements. Women were the main party associated with the use of such brooches. Not only does this indicate a strong female presence within these camps, but also that women played a significant role in presenting Scandinavian colonial identity. The brooches are a firm indicator of family groups existing within the migrating settlements, offering the alternative perspective of life away from simply military triumph.
So these brooches were clearly a symbol of status and success in Viking settlements.
They helped make up the cultural archaeological footprint, which had been left unanswered by pre-existing evidence and theories, but also does fit in quite well with the evidence set out from place names and geographical legacy. Long-term settlements could also be evidenced by Scandinavian place names, which would indicate the occurrence of land seizures in order to carry out the later phase of setting up farmstead for long-term living. But as we said before, our reliance cannot be placed upon the usage of Scandinavian place names, as this can often be simply a change in lordship, and so place names must be used in conjunction with material evidence in order to establish an accurate picture of short-term and long-term Viking settlements.
So over the course of this episode, we have explored how the people of England during the Anglo-Saxon period were diverse and multicultural, and not one unified ethnic group, as the name of this period would imply. Linguistic analysis and the findings from archaeological digs show how the two groups' day-to-day lives shaped the material culture of England during this time, and also their lasting presence, which we can still see around us now. That's all for today. We hope you have enjoyed this episode.